Yes, okay, this worked. So I'm going to start with a bit of a prologue, just due to the fact that recently somebody passed away, who was not Scottish but Canadian, in fact, and so the Scottish accent was just sort of fake. But unfortunately, in this scene, he completely forgot how to do teleportation. So. But fortunately enough, Vulcans have a big brain, so he remembers it, so it wants to communicate it. Now, he opens his book, and that's typically what you find in a book as a description of a teleportation protocol. And if you want to verify it, then you see something like that. Now, let's say the clue of Samson's talk last week was basically that we can do it like this too. Both proof and description. I think this should be... laser. Okay, yeah. So, how do you think about this? So, you've got here two things, and there another thing, and this is labeled by Fi, this is labeled by Fi minus one. You think of it as a bit of a rope, so you can stretch it, which gives you this. Then you see Fi and Fi minus one, they annihilate each other, and you get this, which basically means you've been teleported from there to there. That's the way we describe teleportation in our formalism. And of course, if you want to communicate it, then it's always easy to write things down. And so we can write things down sequentially like that. And you actually interpret, they are typed, you interpret them as things like produce EPR pairs, spatial relocation, Bell-based measurement, classic communication, and unitary correction. But that's just a prologue to my talk. So now my talk really starts. Okay, what is the challenge here? So why did discovering teleportation take 60 years? My claim is that it is to do with a bad quantum formalism because it's much too low level. And the analogy which I write down there, like that good quantum mechanics should stand to the Neumann quantum mechanics as high-level programming language stands to low-level programming language, is actually very exact. Because if you think of a low-level programming language, what is it? It's assembler. So you've got strings of bits 0 and 1, you take a 0-1 valued matrix as an operation on this bit string, and you get another 0-2-1 valued string. That's basically what the Neumann formalism of quantum mechanics does for you. It just replaces 0 and 1 by complex numbers. So it's basically a sophisticated assembler. And what we want to do is like introduce a good quantum mechanics in a sense, like a higher level language which allows you to reason in an easier fashion than just hacking with bits. So the claim is that such a formalism exists, and that's what I'm going to present to you. Of course, the question you can raise is whether it's absurdly abstract coming from us, and the claim is that it could be taught in kindergarten. So which are the acts? Well, the history starts, of course, with Neumann's formalism in 1932. The funny thing is that in 1935, he actually threw away his own baby, more or less, spiritually. So, and that led to actually the developments in quantum logic and all that. So if you think there is something wrong with the grammar, it's either von Neumann or Redé, because I just copied from Redé's paper. So what did we do? We tried to work to on an higher level language. First, we tried to understand the quantum compoundness. And actually something came out, which is the notion of quantum information flow, which Samson strongly addressed in his talk. Now, the moment we tried to axiomatize this quantum information flow, it turned out that we more or less got the whole of quantum mechanics out of it. It was a big surprise. And then in more recent work, we got actually a real quantum logic out of it in the sense of like there is no global phases anymore, so such aspects came out. And we can also deal with things like completely positive maps. So what are the features of the program? Well, first of all, our main assumption is explicit operationalism. So we think the basic ingredients of our formalism are actually processes or operations. And they are typed. So they're primitive data, they are typed, which means this A, for example, stands for 1 qubit, 2 qubits, 3 qubits, whatever your system is you are considering. This is whatever comes out of the process. So if this is the measurement, then this would involve classical information, of course. This doesn't necessarily have to be Hilbert space or anything like that. So of course we can compose things and we can consider pairs of operations and pairs of objects. We can, if we take two qubits, and the point is that we can consider them as one, two, and start acting on them, letting them entangle. So this is basically the standard setting. Now, of course, this looks a bit like I'm trying to settle you up with category theory. And I feel for you, so you don't want to learn that, of course. And the but you don't have to learn that. But we're going to go back in time. We're going to go to a time where we all were still children, because now we're going to draw pictures. And it's the only thing we're going to do. So I'm just going to draw pictures. And this is something nice of category theory, that actually it has some kind of magic which actually allows you to formally justifies its own formal absence. So basically what you do is you start doing some mathematics, you go abstract, and when you're sufficiently abstract, you can actually prove that you don't need the abstraction anymore. You can do something very simple and trivial. And that's the thing I'm going to present to you, the very simple, trivial thing, which is justified by some abstract stuff behind the scene. So the language is going to be purely graphical. Behind the scene, categorical algebra is going on. One concrete model, of course, is Hilbert space. And many others, but stuff I'm not going to assume are things like number fields, Petri's calculus, vectors, sums, and all the sort of stuff you think you assume as like first straight citizen, typically in quantum mechanics. So this is my primitive data. So this is a physical process. This can be anything. This can be a measurement. This can be a unitary transformation. This can be sending classical data. This is a physical process of type A to type B. So type A determines to what you can apply it. Type B determines what do you get out of it. So there is a difference, for example, for a destructive measurement and a non-destructive measurement, because you get something different out of it at the end. If I put a line, that means identity, doing nothing. Then I've got these things which I'm going to call state. This is for state preparation. They start in nothing and they end in something, A. So then I, for example, could do this one. And I've got also something like co-states, which are states like depicted upside down. And then I've got this weird thing which is called scalar. It has no line in, no line out, it's just hanging there. That's a scalar. So we can do operations on these things. For example, we can compose them. We can start with a state and act on it. We can start with a state and then do a co-state, which actually produces something of this kind, which I call scalar or number. You can do things next to each other. You can do an operation F and do nothing on C, for example. You can combine something with a scalar. It's like assigning a probability weight to something. We can have combined types, or we can have like this sort of separation. And we can just pair a state with a co-state. And now, but this is like the real primitive data and the two primitive operation. Now I'm going to bring in some structure. And that's actually all. That's my language which I'm going to use. So the structure which I'm going to bring in is that I'm going to orient these lines. I'm not just taking this line as non-oriented. I'm going to orient it. And whenever I reverse it, instead of A, I write A star. Then I assume that there is an operation which allows me to put this thing upside down. So I've got a thing from A to B, I put it upside down, I get something from B to A. Finally, I assume also that these weird things exist, which is something which starts with nothing, so it's of the type state. It's of the type state, and it has an A star and an A as a pair of outputs. So it's something like this, but the A and the B are now gone. So it's more of a type state. And so I've got the same thing upside down, because I've got this operation which allows me to put things upside down. And then this actually is just interpretation-wise, I'm going to put a line there. So you don't have to put it. You can just think of it as this, but it's going to be a good idea just to think of this and that this line bends there. So it comes in, it gets mirrored on the plate, it goes out again. And the reason why it's good to think on that is because I've got one axiom. This is my only axiom in my formalism. And this axiom, basically, what it does is the following. It's a... let me take this out. So what it does is this. I've got a loop, and then I stretch. That's what I do. See the black line? It's a loop, and I stretch. That's my only axiom I'm going to use. Okay, so I'm going to start proving things now, because now we have a language. This is my language. So I've got all these ingredients. So I've got primitive data. I've got two operations, like putting things next to each other and putting things sequentially after each other. And I've got these pieces of structure. this reversal of the error of the object there, reversal of the morphisms or of the processes, and these weird state things. Okay, let's start proving things. So I start from this, then I take this top part and wing a little bit to the right. Then you see I sort of shift things around a bit more, and then I swap the top half and I get this one. So I just prove the theorem. From my axiom, I can prove this one. So this is my first theorem. It's not very interesting, but it shows that this is an equivalent action to the previous one. Okay, now I'm going to start like defining derived concepts. These I will define as the entangled F state. So the pink triangle I will call the EPR state, and this I call the entangled F state, and I define it as follows. I take an EPR state, and then I put a process there, a process F, and I call the whole thing the entangled F state. And I do a similar thing for something upside down like that. So I define this, the entangled F co state. Now I can again start proving things. I take an F state, I take a G co state. I put in the definition. See, I just sort of put the little boxes down. There I find part of my theorem which I just proved, this one, so I can replace it by this one. So that's what I obtain at the end. So this is again a theorem. This is already a funny one, because if you think of it physically, so time, you have to think of time going upwards. Then you see first I do G, and then I do F something. And here at the end, I first get an F, and then I get a G. So there is some sort of weird reversal of causality going on in the picture. It's logical. There is some logical reversal of causality, it seems, in the way I have to read. If I go from bottom to up, I first encounter G and then F, and there I first encounter F and then G. In similar ways, you can also prove this one, which is, you see, I've got an F state, and I've got an H state, and I've got a G co state. And then when I sort of stretch the thing, I get this one. So the G sort of squeezes inside. So this is all my formalism. And then I've got a thing which I define bipartite projector. And that's how it looks. So it has two inputs. One I call A star, because the arrow is going down. One B. There I've got again an A star and a B. And here, this is the thing we call an F state. And here, this is something almost like an F co state. It's a bit different. It's a tiny bit different than what I call the co state. Because here in the co state, I've got an F there. And in the other one, I've got an F dagger on the other side. But it will turn out that it's almost the same thing. So it's almost this. And just for mnemotechnical reasons, it's better to remember it as this. And now we can again start proving things. So we have a concept of binary state, bipartite state. We have a concept of bipartite projector. And this is the first color here, which I'm going to call fold it under the name designing protocols. This is the first color here. So if I do, this is already proved. It's very trivial, but I'm going to give you the name, this result. I call it 1/4 teleportation. And I think of this as there being a projector. And like this pink triangle is just part of a projector, because I define a projector in this way. See? And I just take two pink triangles here. Okay, now if I replace the top half and I again apply the other proposition, then I get this one. And this I call full teleportation. So when I assume that these eyes are labeled between 1 and 4. You see, I can do the following. I've got Fi there, and then if I put an Fi minus 1 both there and both there, then it falls away, so I get this one. That's actually the real full teleportation, because this state which goes in comes out there. And this is what I call logic gate teleportation. I just put an F state there, and I get there F as a process. This is logic gate teleportation. And this I call entanglement swapping. So you can follow the line here. You see these two are connected by a pink triangle, by an EPR state, this one and this one. And after the process, this one is connected by a line, and that one is connected by a line. So that's entanglement swapping. Okay. Now I'm going to show that actually the silly thing I've been presenting is actually quantum mechanics, includes quantum mechanics. So I'm going to now prove that there is a model of it which I call the von Neumann-Dirac model of my picture calculus. First of all, I'm going to interpret these boxes as linear maps. I think of this as a state. Well, actually, I'm going to think of it as a map from the complex numbers to a Hilbert space. But this is the same as picking out a state, because you actually look at the image of one. And I'm going to think of this as a map from the complex numbers to the complex numbers, which is, again, a complex number, because you just pick out the image of one, and then by linearity, the whole map is just determined by picking out that one number. So I think of this as a complex number. I think of this as a vector, but actually it's a map from the complex numbers to H, because otherwise I don't have a sense of composition, of course. And this will be the conjugate Hilbert space of H, which is the same Hilbert space, but just the complex numbers play the conjugate role in it. F dagger, so the putting the things upside down will be the adjoint, the linear adjoint. I think of this thing as a cat. I think of this thing as a bra. I'm just, throughout the talk, I'm just going to denote phi for actually, for phi dagger, because I cannot get phi dagger within my blue boxes. So, and this is a bracket. So this is the inner product. Just putting two things together like that. And that's how you define a cat bra, for example, a mixed state. This would be, for example, this would be, for example, the projector representing a pure state, if this phi equals to psi. So, okay. We can look at things like that. So I just take a state and then a process of it, so I can write it like this. If I put this upside down, then I can write this like this. Okay, and then just the concept of a joint is, the concept of a joint is, which means putting something upside down, this follows from that previously. If I write this down here, we can just copy this picture. This one is the, is the state in the beginning. And this picture actually is actually the same thing as this thing. So I just proved that we have this usually defining property of the adjoint for free from the picture calculus. It's automatically satisfied. So the picture calculus satisfies this property. If we define unitarity as the inverse equals the adjoint, then we can write this thing down. I put the picture down. These two annihilate each other, because that's by definition of unitarity. So we just proved that inverses that unitarities preserve the inner product. So this just comes for free out of the picture calculus. So the simple calculus which I presented in the beginning already has these two properties: this property for an adjoint and this property for a unitary map. So angle preservation, if you want to. This just comes from the pictures, and I didn't use anything else so far. So now, just to show that, just continuing my Hilbert space quantum mechanics case, this will be interpreted as the EPR state. This will be interpreted as the adjoint of the EPR state, and you can actually calculate that this is the linear extension of the inner product. So you take the inner product of two states like that. Then the adjoint of the EPR state, the EPR state seen as a map from the complex numbers to the tensor product, turns out to be the inner product. And then you can do the following easy calculation. I write down this and this. This is actually nothing. You just take accepting a value there. This is the EPR state, yes, which I can rewrite like this. Then I apply this thing to its first argument, which is the inner product. And then you just get a decomposition of the identity. So the axiom is satisfied in Hilbert space. So I just proved that Hilbert space is a valid model of my picture calculus. So everything I've proved so far before, like the teleportation and all the things I call teleportation and angle entanglement swapping, they are true in Hilbert space. Because it's true in my picture calculus, and Hilbert space is the model of my picture calculus. So, okay, and so I'll leave it as an exercise, because I think this is a fact a lot of people are not aware of, that any bipartite projector which projects on a one-dimensional subspace can be decomposed in this way in Hilbert space, where this is the inner product, and this is the EPR state represented as a map from the complex numbers to the EPR state. Then you've got there a linear map and a linear map there. And then you will get the bipartite, then you will get what you will get. So if you consider the isomorphism between tensor product and the space of linear maps, what you actually get there is, if I take a linear map here, then this corresponds to a bipartite state here. So if I put in the linear map there, then I get a projector on this one, the one-dimensional subspace space spanned by this state. That's what I get out of if I calculate it using these components which I defined. So okay, we're going to continue by theorem proving. And actually, the thing I want to prove is this one now. But I'm not going to prove it in Hilbert space. I'm going to prove it in my picture calculus. I'm going to show that this is true just in the picture calculus using the one axiom which I defined. So everybody knows this fact, I guess, that the tensor product, of two Hilbert spaces is isomorphic to the space of linear map. You just write down a bipartite state in this way, and then you consider this as a matrix, and then you take the linear map function with this matrix. The fact that there is a star occurring there has to do with the fact that here we've got a bra, and there actually we've got I under a ket. So I'm going to prove this thing, but I'm going to prove this thing not in Hilbert space, but in my picture calculus, relying on my only axiom, of course. So it's a bit of a weird statement. So I'm going to prove that in my picture calculus, the set of these maps of purple boxes, say labeled by F, has to be isomorphic to the set of blue triangles, always. Which the set of here there is an A, there is a B, there is an A star, there is a B. And I say that in any picture calculus which satisfies my axiom, this thing has to be satisfied. Okay, and the claim is that this is the bijection which does it. So you just put a pink triangle under the F. First, I prove injectivity. Assume that these two things are equal. What do? I put another pink triangle there at both sides. I use my axiom and I get this. Next, I'm going to prove surjectivity. I claim that this one, under the bijection which I define here, under this bijection, I claim that this one will produce this one. So let's see. Yes, I just apply my morphism and I get this one. I just proved surjectivity. Injectivity and surjectivity, you mean? I didn't hear it very well. No, these are pure set theoretic properties. So what I'm trying to prove is that if I take this graphical calculus, any graphical calculus which satisfies one axiom, the one axiom which I showed, then in this calculus, the set of all purple boxes of this kind has to be isomorphic to the set of all blue boxes of this type. And injectivity and surjectivity is just like the two components of bijectivity set-wise. So I just claim that there is always a bijection between these two. Which, of course, here this is an isomorphism of Hilbert spaces. Yes, in this case. But you can think of it as a set theoretic isomorphism. So and that's what I show, that in this abstract language, you have to have this, always. And so it's really set theoretic bijectivity and injectivity, which I showed. So this property, which you prove you by the way I did it, by looking at the matrix, can be proved without any reference to anything like a matrix. Just the only thing you have to rely on is, where is it? This action, this thing which was my action. That's the only thing you have to rely on to prove that in this calculus. So it's a bit remarkable fact. Well, it's not remarkable if you know where it comes from, but it's okay. So I'm going to prove some more things. So I'm going to define. I'm going to define a new type of. I'm going to define a new type of object in my calculus. So I define F star to be this picture given an F. So I define a green box, F upper star, to be a purple box, and then two pink boxes. Just the definition. And I call it upper star. And I do the same. I define something else, which I call lower star. And now I just put the adjoint there. It's slight modification. So I defined two things. Here they are again. Actually made that green. I forgot to make that green, but it doesn't matter. And then I start calculating. I'm going to calculate the upper star from the lower star. So I write it down here. I apply my axiom twice. I've got this, and I've got this. I apply it twice, and I get this. So I just showed that upper star and lower star always has to decompose as the adjoint. Are two factors of the adjoint. You see this? If I start with this one, I just apply my action twice, I get this one. So, and actually the other one, this is like upper star after lower star is equal to the adjoint, and you can also prove that lower star after upper star is equal to the adjoint. So we actually discovered within the picture calculus that the adjoint always has to factor in two components, and of course, in the Hilbert space case, these are respectively transposition and complex conjugation. So what does this mean? Like, the fact that an adjoint factors over two things is always true, even in the picture calculus. You always have two different operations, one which corresponds to transposition, and one which corresponds to complex conjugation. Okay, we have a concept of trace, partial trace. So what you do is you take something which has two inputs, two outputs, and then you take triangle, you make a loop, and you get something out. Now the important case there is the full trace. That if I take one of these, and I just put two triangles there, then I can make a loop. No inputs anymore, no outputs, so I get something of the type which I call diamond. And actually, we can think of this as that there is a probabilistic weight sitting on this purple box. So for each purple box, just using these pictures, we actually can extract a number. And we think of this as the probabilistic weight of this purple box. So I'm just still using my pictures and all that and extracting concepts from it. Okay, let's see what we can prove. So I just remind you what the F upper star is. So we can do this. You see, here is the upper star. If I put, then you can easily show that this has to be true. You start with this one. So this means I put a pink triangle here. So this one and whatever I put there would annihilate each other, you get this one. And obviously, you can prove this one. So this is a general result, so result in our calculus again. So you can swap two things within such a loop. This is the result if, for example, know that within the scope of a trace, you can swap linear operators. You can sort of permute them around. This I get in the picture calculus too. This is the result which I just proved. Okay. So it's actually a relative, it's not an absolute significance, it's relative. It's like with electricity, you choose what the positive direction of the current is, but if H is an Hilbert space, and then I define H star, so reversing arrow is just a primitive operation in the abstract calculus, but if I've got H, then I take here the same Hilbert space with the same vectors, but I take as complex numbers the conjugate. So it's completely isomorphic to this one, but I identify a complex number here, there, with its conjugate. It doesn't have an absolute meaning even to talk about. It's a relative thing. Time goes up. So time goes up. This is sort of logical thing which I introduced to make the axiom easy readable. Why? There are two things going on here. So there is absolute time, which just goes up. So this is the you do a number of calculations. And for example here, you would first do this operation, then you do this operation, then you do this operation, and then you do this operation. Now, what the black arrow means, it's a logical interpretation. It's a logical interpretation of the axiom. It's a logical interpretation of the axiom, which says that if you take first one like that, and then you take first, then well, no, you take first one like this, and then one like that, then this, then you connect these like this, then this has to be equal to nothing. That's an axiom. Now, the way to read this axiom, to interpret this axiom, is this, as if you think that there is a flow here, a line, and that you stretch it. So these arrows, these black arrows, are actually interpretational. And with the same idea, you think of this as a loop, a closed loop. These things actually trace back to the 70s when Penrose started to use diagrammatic calculi for tensor calculi. He specifically applied this then to space-time. But that's where the origin of this sort of calculi comes from Penrose in the 70s. And so it's actually, in general, in category theory, it's sort of nice subject that people are trying to understand very abstract spaces with graphical calculi. Knot theory is an example of that, braidings. But I'm just doing it now for quantum mechanics, for plain quantum mechanics. Okay, so what I want to show now is that there are two representations of the Born rule which I can prove to be equivalent in my calculus. First of all, everybody knows that you can write the Born rule like that in terms of a trace and in terms of an inner product. And I want to show you that in my, yes? well, this is a circuit. This is a circuit, but not the black line. This is a circuit. This is a state preparation, yes? Then you apply this projector here to this side. So this would be part of the measurement. Like, you just think of it as a conditional projection. Do you know which? This would be, again, something like a projector, because it's like a bra, a cat and a bra. And this would then, again, this is again a bra. So you see, you can think of them as parts of circuits. Now, the structural part is the loop, which is not physical. The loop is really the structure. That's the mathematical structure. The whole thing I'm trying to show is that by assuming this sort of flow, which goes forth and back as the only mathematical structures in terms of such an axiom, you get an amazing amount of quantum mechanics structure out of this. That's what I'm trying to say. Just this single axiom here is the only thing I'm using, which has this sort of graphical interpretation of stretching a rope, gives you all these concepts. Like, I'm from nothing else than that, I'm now going to prove that these two versions of the Born rule are equal. And it's very simple. So I start with this one. Just before I proved that I can, within such a thing, actually it's as if you take this G and you sort of pull it around the circle. So you start with this G, you just completely pull it around the circle, and then it's there. So the in terms of the interpretation, this is a very trivial result. You can just pull this around. You can prove this explicitly like that, but that's actually what you do. So using this fact, see, I start with this one. Now I'm going to take this blue and pull it around the circle, completely there. I get this, but there are no, in this sort of state and this sort of co-state, they don't have a line there, so I can just drop it. And actually, this is the inner product representation which is there. So it's totally trivial. The only thing you do is just pull this once around. And that gives you like the inner product representation of this. So, of course, there is real algebra going on here. So you can actually axiomatize all these things in some sort of category Samson Abramsky and I introduced, which is called strong compact closure. And then this axiom here looks like something like that, like some weird commutative diagram, and all the pieces of data and structure can also be axiomatized. So but basically, this weird diagram here is nothing else than this. So this categorical diagram, this is actually this equation. So, and then you have stuff like that, which I talked about also in the category theory course. Diagrams like this can be interpreted as this sort of movements you can do with your boxes, just like swapping, like shifting one box over another one, and then sort of pulling it when they cross, like this. This G just goes there, and this F goes there, and even this. So this is the stuff which is happening behind the scene. There are these very weird things structurally, which I discussed last week too, which are the straight scalars, which you get in any monoidal category basically for free, and behaves like the scalars in any matrix calculus. And actually, intrinsically in the axiomatic structure, there is also something which captures basically the fact that you cannot clone and delete. So because if you would have like cloning, then you want the maps like this. And if you would have deletion, then you want maps like this. So this doubles, this takes away something. And these are exactly things when you have a categorical product. But fortunately enough, the sort of categories we use really don't like Cartesian closure and these things. So the copying and deleting is very much excluded by the sort of axiomatics we put on our category, which is, of course, a good thing. Now, so far, although I did discuss the Born rule, you might think that all the things I've been talking about still quite qualitative. Now I'm going to show, and this actually brings me more to the topic of the conference on quantum logic, that at this abstract level, there is going to be an operation eliminating global phases. So if I put down a picture calculus, then sometimes you still have, that actually there is a concept of global phase living there on this picture, which is very weird. But I'm going to show some results which like indicate that. And actually, I have an operation to get away of the global phases. If you think about it, when you say that any two states are equivalent whenever they are equal up to a global phase. So that's the sort of thing which lives at this abstract level, and you can get rid of the global phases. Typically, you go from a projective calculus, from a vectored space calculus, then to a projective calculus. So these sort of things you can do at this abstract level. So first of all, I'm going to need two little concepts here. I claim that the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, the squared Hilbert-Schmidt norm, is nothing but this picture. So, and you can prove that. So that what in Hilbert space we call the Hilbert-Schmidt norm is nothing but this picture. Like, here is a proof. So this is actually just riding out in Hilbert space. So I told you that you have things like, I said that this is an EPR state and this is its set joint. So I'm not going to go explicitly through calculation, but you see, for example, here is the EPR state, and then the inner product plays the role of the adjoint. It shows up here. So you actually show that indeed, in the Hilbert space case, this picture represents the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, and actually this is actually the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, this picture. You can show that too. And so, okay, now I'm going to my global phases. So in Hilbert space, you have the following. If I've got a linear map which is equal to another one up to a phase, then I can get rid of the phase by doing the following trick. I pass to the tensor product of this linear map and its adjoint. And then you can calculate. You've got the phase here, you've got the phase there, but you'd have to take the adjoint, which is the complex conjugate. So these two annihilate each other, and my phase is gone. So this, if two things are equal up to a global phase, then just by passing to the tensor product of this thing and its adjoint, phase is gone. Now, we can prove the following, which is not a big surprise. Abstractly, I'm going to write this down as a picture. So what do I have there? I use this notation, S dot F, for a scalar S and a box F. So this thing is my notation for this. So what do I say is that if these things are, if something like this is equal to something like that, and these two scalars satisfy that if you compose them with their adjoints and they get one, then, so let me write this down. So if I've got this and I've got, then this one is upside down. So this is equal to then we have the this one F negative is equal to this. You can prove easily, it's very trivial. Now, the reason I bother writing this all down is because there is a sort of reverse result which is not at all trivial. And this is the following. That if these two are equal, if this is equal to this, I claim that then there exist S and T such that S dagger is equal to T dagger. So, and this thing is also true. So I reverse the arrow here. It's a very weird result if you read it like that. If these two pictures are, if I get an equality on pictures of this form, then there exists two diamond type pictures, S and T, such that this is equal to this and this is equal to this. This is very weird. And my claim is that these two scalars, which these two things which occur here, are exactly the Hilbert-Schmidt norm and the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. So I'm going to give you the proof of this. So I'm going to encode it like I did on the blackboard. So this is given. This is given. This is this thing. Huh? This is given. So I say this is the. I claim that this S and for this T, we have the following. That this one is equal to that one, which I write down as this one. And this is the proof. Look, it's going to go very quick. Thanks. That's the proof. So this is what I have to prove, and this is the proof, because this was my assumption. This was my assumption. This is what I have to prove, and this is the proof. So I also have to prove this. I'm going to do that again. So I write them out. So twice. This is Hilbert-Schmidt norm, Hilbert-Schmidt norm, Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. Proof. That was the proof. You have to be quick to see it. Thank you. That's the proof. So what did I do here? So basically what these results tell us is that there is really an operation global phase living at such an abstract level of this picture calculus, and you can actually get rid of it if you want to by passing from this sort of picture to this picture. Then you eliminate global phases. Oh, that's what I just showed. So from a quantum logic perspective, this is the following. This is what we are doing. Typically in quantum logic, what people did was the following. You start from a Hilbert space. Look at my time. Okay, I'm getting almost. So you start from a Hilbert space, then you kill the global phases, and then you go abstract, for example, to lattices or something like that. That's what the tradition of quantum logic always has been. You start from a Hilbert space, you kill the redundant global phase, you go to the lattice of closed subspaces, and then you go abstract. That was the idea of Birkhoff and Neumann. What's happening here is the following. We start from the whole category of Hilbert spaces, so thinking of all the morphisms in the linear functions as processes. We first go abstract, and we get some sort of vectorial strong compact closure, and then we kill the redundant global phase, and we get a projective version. So we do have a projective formalism for quantum mechanics, because we can do it at this abstract level. And interestingly enough, like what we actually, I just said that to kill global phases, you have to pass to from a morphism F to F tensor F dagger. So we can now put an axiom down which says there are no global phases, which means that if we apply this thing, then F has to be equal to G. So we're going to look for a fixed point of this construction which eliminates global phases. And actually, what this physically means, you can really read this, because these two things are actually only equal if the corresponding projectors are equal. You can actually use the sort of closeness thing which I did for that, that we actually just ask that equal preparations produce equal states. This is a very innocent physical assumption. Equal preparation produces equal states. But at this abstract level of category theory, you can actually put this down, this action, and you get a formalism. You get a projective quantum formalism for free. So this is the last thing I want to say. So I said you can go projective by going from one picture to from F to the pair F F dagger. So this is so we actually turn a process into what you could call projective. So no global phases anymore. Now let us introduce an ancilla there. We introduce an ancilla. And now we're going to hide the ancilla. You see, the ancilla is gone because we put like this connection there. And recently it has been shown that exactly this procedure produces completely positive maps. So what you obtain here, this is a completely positive map. So in the specific case of Hilbert space, so what we get is like an abstract counterpart to the notion of completely positive maps. And you can start proving things about completely positive maps just using these simple pictures. It goes very easy. So to conclude, what is the full categorical quantum mechanics? You start, of course, with obvious things like we had system, we have composite, we had morphisms, we have tensor. A state is something of this form. An evolution would be a unitary, which we can define. And measurement you think of as a family of projectors or completely positive maps if you want, or positive maps or whatever, depending on your taste. And you've got a probability law and all that. So the only thing we actually were not able at this stage to bring in is like when are two when is a family of measurements, when a family of projectors, when do they really constitute the measurement? You want them to be orthogonal, of course. That's the only bit of structure we're actually missing at this point. So you can, this would be another talk in itself, but so this is the little piece of additive structure you actually still have to bring in besides the pure picture calculus. And that specification of what are a good family of projectors which constitute the measurement, and how do you combine such a family in a single morphism? Now, this can be done. And actually, at this stage, you can actually make the choice whether you really want the vector space style formalism, a projective formalism, or a generalized measurement style formalism, depending on if you want interpretational concerns even. So this thing we did last year is very easy. This was much harder to get the additive structure going for the projective. And then this is actually things we are working now on. And this actually interferes with like certain developments people have been talking about here. And you can actually try to really firmly encode this sort of stuff within your formalism because it's just such a wide axiomatic freedom. You hardly start from anything. You really hardly start from any assumption. And you get so far in quantum mechanics. So it's very easy to add something. So Anyway, what are the sort of applications of these things? Why computer scientists would actually care about these things is, of course, quantum protocol in a further stage program, algorithm design, and verification. And actually, this thing might also enable to provide the appropriate semantics for actually new quantum computational paradigms, such as the one-way teleportation-based schemes, measurement-based in general, or things like topological quantum computation. Because you're working at such a high level of abstraction, which actually means such a minimal level of assumptions, that there is so much place to put all the things in your structure. We also have representation. Actually, it's funny enough, for this sort of structure, there already exists a representation theorem by the linear. And I just put on the references again. And that's the end of the talk. Cool. Thank you.
Very early in your talk, you asked the question, why did it take 60 years to invent repetition? And I assume that the answer that you operate because we didn't have your homework back then.
So high-level tools, yeah.
But as one of the original teleporters, I'd like to offer a different perspective, which is that it didn't take 60 years, it took a few hours.
Yeah, okay.
The
yeah.
reason why it took so long before it came along is because you have to before you even ask a question. But when we asked ourselves the question, if Alice and Bob are restricted to classical communication, and he wants to do something collectively, could I take a little help? Well, within a few hours, the teleporting was invented.
Yes, no, of course, I agree with that. But the thing is, if this formalism, it would be just like up front.
It would be obvious perhaps once you take up a question.
What?
It would be obvious once you take up a question. The hard thing was.
Yeah, but that's part of the that's actually part of what I'm saying. You wouldn't ask that sort of question, obviously, in a vector space like formalism. The thing is, like teleportation is also true for relations. Of course, you never thought, nobody asked that for, but teleportation is like, well, this is actually a sort of fancy linear algebra, what we're doing here. And what is, for example, an example of linear algebra? Matrices in 0 and 1, which are relations. So relations completely satisfy most of these axiomatics. Relations with then Cartesian product. So of course, nobody ever asked the question, can you do teleportation with relations? But it just gives a different, now the teleportation part is only one part. The funny part is also that you get also the quantitative thing out of this single assumption, like the numbers. So and we didn't do a lot of quantitative protocols yet. That's actually the next channel, like a challenge. How far can we get with this on topic of numbers? Because, of course, teleportation is basically the only protocol which sort of obvious. Well, we put it in by hand, basically. We put it in. This is the axiom. So this is teleportation. And what we more or less do, we take the multiplicative fragment of teleportation, which assumes that you condition on sending classical information. And we see how far can we get with this for quantum mechanics. So, and in some sense, you could think of this as you start from the idea of that quantum mechanics allows this sort of magical flow, which you cannot do classical, this non-local flow. See how far do we get by just assuming that you can do that thing. That's another way of looking at it then. Of course, we assume it almost. Let's see. Yeah. So that's actually, you agree, that's actually another way of putting it. We just assume. Is basically, and then we see how far we can get. Yes, yeah. of course, structurally, there is a strong analogy with this thing like Feynman diagrams and all that, and that's the interpretation you're giving now, I think. But this, like when I write down this triangle, this is not a full measurement, this is just one projector. Yeah? So, now, to make a full measurement, you need to put here. So this would be, if I put any morphism R Fi, this would make this thing into another measurement as a whole. So I just need to find four of these. Even in the Bell base, I need to introduce these things to have like four orthogonal vectors. So So, but this is the idea of co-state. That's what I call the co-state. So in the same way that this is the EPR state. If I put a linear function here, I can find any other state. This is how I get any other state. And if I put it upside down, I get any other measurement like that. It's because you've got this, yeah? Yeah? Yeah, actually, the thing is I was a bit dodgy here. Like, I just said you put an fi here, and then you do the corresponding correction here. Fi minus one, yeah? You do the corresponding correction there. Now, if you really want to be decent, you have to bring in another piece of extra structure to make this more implicitly represented. That's actually the last thing I talked about where that's which I didn't talk. So you would start doing things to really combine them. You want to write one morphism which represents the whole protocol, of course. And then you need to bring in a little bit of extra structure, which is the edit, which says when two things are orthogonal and how you can combine them into one thing. Yeah. Compact closure doesn't like Cartesian closure. That's what I said. So. Your category completely collapses down if you want to have compact closure and projections. Yeah, well, it's a negative thing. Like you cannot. We don't have that. Like we don't have the process of cloning and deleting because it's very incompatible with the entanglement. Actually, we have the entanglement, so you can then verify in the abstract that these things are very incompatible, having cloning and deleting. And so, okay, it's probably worth to do a full logical analysis, like how incompatible are they, and that's maybe what you mean. Because you could, for example, assume one and not the other and sort of do a real call. Actually, that's something we've been thinking about recently. So to make it really explicit, like how logically different are, for example, cloning and deleting. The Linnaeus theorem, if I remember well, you take in, so in, where is it? The Linnaeus theorem, you need full byproducts, so you need compact closure, full abelian category, so negative means inverses, additive inverses and all that. I think you assumed a field, algebraically closed field. You really have to put it, but there is a representation theorem, like for example, for lattices, you've got the Pirot representation theorem. What do you have to put on a lattice to get Hilbert space? Well, this exists also for this sort of categories. It exists in Snake. So you know what you have to put in, but you have to put in an awful amount of stuff, of course. Just the matrix calculus, basically.